People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Trevor Francis, 33 years in football as a player and a manager.
Trevor, thank you so much for coming in and joining us today. And looking forward to speaking to you for a while. So it's a great thrill for me. My first question is, how did you go from being a boy from Plymouth down the West Country to signing for Birmingham, your first club, which seems to me like, you know, well, it is quite a long way away.
Well, in all honesty, I didn't have too much choice. I'll just give you a little bit of background. I was playing for Plymouth Schools in the English Schools Trophy.
Yeah.
And I was spotted by Birmingham City. I had a particularly good game up in Birmingham where I scored a hat-trick. But apart from Birmingham, the only other options that were open to me were Bristol City and the local team, Plymouth Argyle. So it wasn't a too difficult choice. Mm. I decided that I would go up to Birmingham at the age of 15. And my ambition was to play consistently in the youth team.
Okay. And then what happened?
Well, I did do that. I did play consistently, scored a number of goals on the Saturday morning when we used to play. And then I had a kind of handful of games in the reserves before I was promoted straight into the first team at the age of 16. And, you know, it was quite a start for me. Scored on my debut against Oxford United. I mention Oxford United because the Atkinson brothers were actually playing. Mm. And of course, you know very, very well Ron Atkinson, who has just had his 80th birthday, a very close friend of mine, who was actually marking me on the day. And he always tells people that he had me in his pocket.
Is that true?
Well, he goes on to say that I had one kick in the whole match. He said, mind you, it was the goal.
But and Ron, he's a lot older than you, so he was probably an old hand at that point as well.
Yeah, Ron's been a great guy over the years. He's tried to buy me on one or two occasions. On both occasions, actually, when he was Manchester United manager. But I finally did play for him at Sheffield Wednesday.
You've seen football through the years as a player and as a manager and as a media guy as well. Give people a bit of a flavour about what the process was when you were that age back in those days. I mean, because I think you made your debut in around 1970. How different it was then? What was the process? How did they just say, look, to your mum and dad, look, we want to sign the boy. Can we sign him? And that was that.
Well, I signed at the age of 14. That was 1969. And I have a little wry smile now at some of the signing on fees.
Yeah.
Just as a matter of interest, my mum and dad were actually given as a signing on fee a washing machine.
Is that true?
That is absolutely true. I was earning £7 a week, which was fair enough as an apprentice professional.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was quite fair when I was playing regularly in the first team.
No.
But that's what it was. £7. You know, I remember scoring four goals as a 16-year-old at St Andrews against Bolton on a Saturday afternoon. And then on the Monday, I was out looking at that pitch whilst I was sweeping the terraces.
Wow, really?
Yeah. And so it's all changed now. I don't think for the better, to be honest. I think that, you know, when we were apprentices, there were 15 of us and we had our regular duties every day to do. I wasn't given any special compensation because I was, you know, one of the lads. Mm. Although, you know, I was playing sometimes on the Saturday afternoon. Used to wash the baths, you know, clean the manager's car. Used to do all these things. And you know what it gave you? Mm. It gave you a real discipline. Mm. And I think some of these youngsters today, they go on to these big salaries, which I don't begrudge them, but I just think that, you know, doing what we did as apprentices, it really sort of stood you in good stead.
Do you think the big salaries would perhaps take away some of their hunger?
A little bit. You know, it was special for me, you know, obviously playing in the first team as a 16-year-old, but I didn't change dressing room. I was still in with the young boys. And if I had to go into the first team dressing room, it would mean a little knock on the door, you know, before you walked in. You know, you looked up to these guys. I remember ringing home once on a Friday night saying, you know, I've just spoken to, you know, one of the first team players, sadly no longer with us, a guy called Trevor Hockey, who actually was a Welsh international who played, you know, for Birmingham City. You know, I'd spoken to Trevor. I was so thrilled about it. I don't think it's quite like that now.
No, I wouldn't think so. When you said that your parents were given a washing machine as kind of a signing on bonus for you going to Birmingham, did you then go and live in digs away from your parents at that age?
Yeah, it was very difficult for myself, but
yeah, it must have been hard.
Even more difficult for mum and dad. You know, 14 years of age, you know, losing their boy, not totally losing him, obviously, but you know, and they were in the hands of the football club. They provided the digs for me. I was in three lots of digs, actually, you know, and with some nice families, but it's not the same as being at home.
Were you homesick?
Not homesick, but there was an arrangement where the chief scout, who kind of looked after me, said that after every 3 weeks on a Saturday, I'd be allowed to go home. Now, going home meant going to New Street Station in Birmingham, getting the 6:30 train at night and arriving in Plymouth Station at 12:15, just after midnight. So I look forward to that. And I would stay home then from the Saturday night until the Thursday.
Right.
Then come back for Thursday afternoon. But that didn't last very long because, as I said to you, after a year, I was in the first team. And of course, they couldn't permit that. Not that I wanted to, because I was so thrilled at being in the first team.
Yeah. How did the kind of senior pros at Birmingham take to a young upstart such as yourself, getting in there, grabbing the headlines, scoring goals? Were they welcoming of you, or were they kind of annoyed at some of them that you might take their place?
Well, I'm sure there was a little bit of jealousy. Jealousy's always been part of football, always been part of football teams and in football clubs. But I think by and large, most of them were, you know, excited, if that's the word, not as excited as what I was. But I think that they were just incredible days, because I can't, you know, tell you the exact record, what it was, but, you know, every time I went out, you know, I felt as if I was going to score.
Yeah.
I mean, I talked about the four goals, and then the next game, there was a double that I got. So that's six goals in like two matches. And I had an incredible record of, you know, scoring so many goals in so many games. And I'm sure that as a 16-year-old, I would be guilty of doing many, many things wrong on the field, but I was the kid. It didn't matter. You know, so when there were occasions when I would beat two and three players and stick it in the back of the net, everyone would go absolutely crazy about it. There were other occasions, of course, I'd beat two or three players when I could just drop it off easily. I didn't know the exact time, you know, moment when to drop it off, when to play it easy. You learn those things as you progress in football. So I'm sure that my fellow, you know, colleagues in the team got a little bit frustrated at times with me, but they didn't get frustrated when I kept winning them football matches and earning them money.
Yeah, true. And so let's talk a bit about the type of player you were then, because I remember you as a coach in the 90s, and we'll come on to that. I'm sadly too young really to remember an awful lot of your playing career, but I've watched quite a lot of it back on YouTube when I knew we were going to be talking. And to me, you looked like an intelligent player, two good feet, great finisher, turn of pace as well. How would you describe yourself as a player? I'm making you sound brilliant there, but you were a brilliant player, so it's understandable.
Well, I find this slightly embarrassing. I've never ever been asked this question, but it's a good question. Let's start with my greatest asset was my pace.
Yeah.
There were very few defenders who could match me for pace. Probably one who you may not be that familiar with, you, but he actually played in Italy. He played with me for about 3 years. The first year he didn't play with me. A guy called Pietro Viecavod.
Viecavod, I remember him. Yeah. Sampdoria defender, tough guy.
tough, fast. Yeah. He was about the only player who could match me for pace. I played for England against him when he was playing for Italy, and he was a very, very good defender. So that was one of my biggest assets. I'm pleased you said intelligent, because I think I did play with intelligence.
I think you found, you found space quite well. You were good at sort of finding the space and occupying it.
My movement was very good. Mm. And to have good movement, you need good players who, A, can see the movement, and of course then can execute the pass. Mm. And just quickly moving on to that, you know, there are two or three absolutely brilliant players that I played with in Italy for my team, Sampdoria. Mm. We were permitted two foreign players per team, Liam Brady and then Graham Souness. But I'm slightly digressing there, so back to myself again. A very good crosser of the ball. Mm. You know, there were occasions when I didn't always play in the as a central striker. Mm. In fact, you know, when I played in the European Cup final for Nottingham Forest, I played on the wide right position. Mm. And I was a good crosser of the ball when the ball was stationary, but also when I was running at pace to the byline, I was able to get my foot around the ball in whipping crosses that defenders didn't really expect. Mm. So, those are a few of the assets. Heading the ball, I was reasonably good. Used to get good flick-ons. Wasn't my greatest strength heading the ball. Mm. Anyway, that's enough about myself. Yeah.
Well, the whole interview's about you, Trevor, so we have to... the reason the 2 feet comes in is because I saw video of when you first broke into the team at Birmingham as a very young man, and your finishing just looked very natural. Both feet looked very, very natural. I'm surprised you didn't kind of mention that as one of your...
Yeah, my right foot was stronger than my left, but I used to work, for long periods on afternoons as a young apprentice on my left foot. And I used to work as well on actually trying to execute volleying the ball.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's an important part of football. And I became a very good volleyer of the ball. Mm. You know, there's nothing worse than when that ball comes to you and you think, go on, take it on. Mm. And you do it with confidence. And I used to volley balls very, very well. I obviously scored a number of goals, but I never considered myself to be an out-and-out goal scorer.
Right, okay.
There are certain players who play in forward positions. If they're not scoring, they may not hold down a regular place in the starting lineup. Mm. I always felt that a big part of my game was my ability to create. I've talked about I can pass the ball very well, I had good vision, and I was a very good cross of the ball. So if I wasn't scoring a goal, you know, it wasn't the end of the world because I always felt that I would contribute in other areas.
Sure. And when you broke into the team at Birmingham, of course, they went through a promotion, got promoted to the top flight. But it seems to me that you didn't really look back after that. You were in the team regularly. You played every season for, I think, you know, a good number of years. And then you moved in famously to Nottingham Forest for £1 million, first player to do so. I did actually see a quote from you when I was preparing for this interview saying that you didn't actually particularly like being referred to as the first £1 million player. The quote is, I had 23 years as a player and I won 2 European Cups and managed in 3 cup finals, 52 England caps, but I'm still always introduced as the first £1 million player. Is that tongue in cheek or is that something that kind of you feel is a bit of an albatross around your neck?
No, what it is, if I was to go to a dinner tonight, a sportsman's dinner, I guarantee that I'd be introduced as, we have with us tonight, the first £1 million footballer, Trevor Francis.
Yeah.
That's fine. Yeah. That's fine. I just think, you know, I actually played professional football from the age of 16 until I was 39.
Yeah.
23 years. Now, there aren't many that play at the top level for 23 years. So, you know, there are many things I did in my career. I think, well, you know, sometimes, you know, it's like as if the only thing I ever did was being transferred for £1 million.
Which was not out of your control anyway.
Yeah. But I have to say also that I'm still very, very proud.
You
know, I've just got a taxi here now, and the driver was on about, you know, being the first £1 million footballer.
Was he really?
Oh, yeah. What was it like, you know?
Yeah.
Because I played for a very, very good manager, a very, very demanding manager in Brian Clough, who, you know, we talk about, you know, my goal-scoring exploits. He was a fabulous goal scorer. Mm. So every opportunity that came, you know, whether it be for me or for Woodcock or Bertels, he used to regard it as an easy chance.
Sure, okay. So his standards were so high. Yeah.
Very, very high. He was a special guy, a special manager. I'm fortunate that, you know, with international level as well, I played for the likes of Don Revie, Ron Greenwood, Bobby Robson at club level.
Alf Ramsey?
Yeah. At Birmingham City. He was my manager for a short while at Birmingham. Also the England under 23 manager whilst I was playing for the under 23s. Then at club level, I mentioned Ron Atkinson, John Bond, Graham Souness, Jim Smith, my managers over in Italy. But for me, Brian Clough was the best. He was brilliant.
And I find the fascinating thing about Brian Clough that he can be, obviously he's a controversial character, but and he's firmly part of the football folklore in this country. And obviously there are good reasons for that. Many of the players that he worked with at Nottingham Forest, I believe I'm right in saying, came through and he picked out little gems with Peter Taylor and he would develop them into players. Yeah. You came to the club, as we've talked about, with a big reputation as a great player, as almost a senior pro already. And you were brought in just before, of course, you went on to win the European Cup. How did that affect things with Brian? Because I know that he treated the press conference unveiling your signing with a bit of disdain, really, looking back on it now, the squash racket and all the rest of it. And people can look that up. And he said some things about you, which I would say were quite disrespectful. But was that his way of kind of saying that I'm the big guy here, not you, type thing, because the transfer fee was so large?
You're absolutely right.
Okay.
Living in the Midlands, you know, for many, many years before I signed for Brian Clough, I'd come into contact with him. I knew all about, you know, how he managed. So all this on the day of the signing was all a little bit of a show. You know, he did many, many things for effect. I mean, he was unbelievable at using the press to his own benefit. And he did that on numerous occasions, you know, with myself. I mean, it was the most nerve-wracking day, you know, having to meet Brian Clough and Peter Taylor when I was negotiating, you know, signing for Nottingham Forest. He arrived an hour late. Right. You know, he'd been playing squash across the road in Trent Bridge with Gary Birtles, but that was on purpose. You know, I don't think anyone realised that this was all set up. But listen, you know, he could have been 10 hours late. It wouldn't have made any difference. I was getting the opportunity to play for Brian Clough and the only team, in my opinion, who could actually challenge Liverpool at the time were Nottingham Forest. So, you know, I was fortunate that here I was, you know, for many, many years, I was trying to get away from Birmingham City. Why? Not that I particularly disliked the club. I just wanted to play with better players to give myself a chance of winning things. Now, Birmingham put a huge price tag on my head. It was actually double the transfer record. You know, £1 million was a huge... Doesn't sound much today, but...
But then it was a big deal, of course.
It was a big deal.
Were you annoyed about that? That he can't, that they trying to almost made it difficult for you to move in that reason, for that reason?
I wasn't annoyed because I knew that Brian Clough and Nottingham Forest were involved.
Yeah, okay.
The only other team was Coventry City. Now, Coventry actually offered me a better financial deal, but it wasn't about, you know, finance. What it did do, of course, was it eliminated a number of clubs who would like to have taken me. But I was happy. You know, Nottingham Forest, in the Midlands, Brian Clough. I mean, walking in the dressing room that day, it was like walking into the England dressing room. When I say walking in the England dressing room, I mean, there's so many star players there. You know, I was going for £1 million, but I wasn't, I've never, ever been the big I am. And I never will be. I've always been very, very grounded. And I would like to think that this will come across in this interview. You know, I've never lost sight of the fact that, you know, I'm very, very privileged what I've been given. But I also realise that, you know, along the way, there's been some tough moments, but and there's been some great moments. But I've always tried to keep my feet firmly on the ground. And, you know, walking into a dress room with the likes of Shilton, Viv Anderson, Archie Gemmell, Kenny Burns... it was quite daunting, but I was so excited about it.
But you know, because we talk about a lot about players struggling under the weight of big transfer fees, and in context, no one's really dealt with that more than you have. Yet a few months after you sign, you end up scoring the winning goal in the European Cup final, and that's, you know, that's your legend secured then anyway. You didn't feel the pressure at all. You saw it as an exciting opportunity rather than something to be a burden.
Exciting, but there was enormous pressure on me. I think that comes with playing for Brian Clough and being part of Nottingham Forest and being the first £1 million footballer. And also because at the time, you know, it seems if it's yesterday, but we're talking about, you know, 40 years ago, actually. Quite frightening. It was in the month of February, and the club had just got through to the League Cup final. They were about to play the quarter final of the European Cup. Then, of course, every Saturday there was the league games. So I couldn't get any momentum because I wasn't able to play in the League Cup final. So then possibly didn't want to change the team then for the next week when they won the League Cup final. So I was on the bench. So it was, I was in and I was out. And of course, a lot of people couldn't quite understand this. You know, I was a £1 million footballer, but and I wasn't playing regularly. I understood it. You know, I was also aware of a quirky rule that, you know, if the team did get through to the European Cup final, for some unknown reason, I was able to play in the final. So I followed that very, very closely, of course. You know, we got through to the final and I was given my debut.
In the final.
Don't make sense, does it? Debut in a European Cup final.
Describe the goal you scored to win the European Cup for Nottingham Forest for those who haven't seen it. How would you describe it?
Well, I was in a deep position, probably about 35, 40 yards from goal, when the ball was played by Ian Boyer out to a wide area to John Robertson. Now, John Robertson was an absolute genius.
Fabulous player, wasn't he, John Robertson?
Yep. So well liked by his colleagues. We all regarded John as our best player, probably the best player in Europe at the time.
Really? Okay.
Didn't quite get that recognition, but he was outstanding. And whenever John had possession, you could virtually guarantee that he would provide a cross, going past the fullback, going to the byline. So when he got possession, I had to make up a lot of ground. He did exactly as I mentioned, got past his fullback, crossed to the back stick. And there I was coming in with a header. And listen, I've got to make good contact. I knew exactly what I wanted to do with it. And I did that.
Are you in the moment or is it all instinctive?
Instinctive.
Yeah.
Instinctive. But I scored the goal. It was right on half time. And my momentum took me off the pitch onto the discus circle. And that's another question I'm asked. I mean, if I was to say to you, you know, or tell you, sorry, you know, the top three questions in my career, one would be, what's it like playing for Brian Clough? I'd always guarantee also that, you know, it would be, oh, when you scored that goal, you landed in the discus area. Did it hurt? Well, I'm a very honest person. And if I was lying, I could say, oh, the pain, you know, but I'll be honest with you. It was rubber.
Was it? Okay.
It wasn't concrete.
It wouldn't have hurt you anyway.
No, but to be honest, I think even if it was concrete, the adrenaline as it was, I probably wouldn't have felt it.
No, no, absolutely. And I think we'll go back to Brian just briefly, because obviously he's an interesting character as well. He's held up in such high regard in this country, and perhaps because he passed away, sadly, a number of years ago now, and a lot of the football narrative has moved on, as things do, because football never stops. It is always worth, I feel, reiterating the fact that this is a manager who won back-to-back European Cups with a provincial club, essentially. I don't mean that in a disrespectful way, but they are a provincial club. The reason he's held up in such high esteem is not just because he was an amazing personality, because that is a ridiculously good achievement. And you were at the heart of that, and that must have been some experience.
Plus the league championship.
Yeah, as well, of course.
Having just come out of the old second division, 40 games, I think, unbeaten, numerous league cups.
What made him so good?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask that question because I do get asked that, and I find it very, very difficult trying to answer.
Is it just a bit of an X factor that he had?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, what are the ingredients to become a good manager? Today, it seems primarily to be about how good a coach you are, how good you are on the training field. Well, I have to say immediately that Brian didn't really believe in coaching.
Right.
At the start of the season, he used to instruct his trainer what he expected. You know, if it was a free kick or a corner, simplicity was a word that he often, you know, used. And we would have maybe two free kicks, two corners, and we had to do those. You know, we couldn't stray away from what he wanted. So he wasn't big on coaching. When the game started, he never missed anything on that field.
Mm.
He had an unbelievable eye, you know. His ability, you know, as a, how can I put it? Well, it wasn't just Brian, it was Peter as well.
Mm.
I think it'd be unfair just to talk about Brian Clough as the manager, because Peter, you know, his input was so, so valuable.
Mm.
But I have to say, there was only one number one, and that was Brian Clough.
Yeah.
You know, Peter Taylor was instrumental in many of the signings. He had an eye for a player. But when it came to man management, Brian Clough was exceptional. There were times when, you know, Brian would decide that he needed a rest, so he'd go off to his little hideaway in Mallorca, and we were never quite sure, you know, whether he'd be back in time for the match. I always recall one midweek game, League Cup match at Vicarage Road against Watford. We arrived at the ground around 6:15, and Brian wasn't on the coach, and we got in the dress room. He wasn't about. Once it got past 6:30, we were aware then that Brian Clough wasn't going to be there. It was solely Peter Taylor. And you could just sense the intensity had gone out of the occasion.
Really?
Players just started to relax, just started to take things easy. And it didn't bode well, you know, for the game that was only an hour away.
Mm.
You're going to say to me, what was the result?
Mm.
We lost 4-0.
Wow, okay. So he had that much of an effect. So it seems to me, I'm a big follower of what Brian did, and I'm a big fan of his work, obviously, but it was a lot of it was a bit before my time. But it seems to me, from the outside looking in, he was like some kind of supreme psychologist type. He could just read people. Every time I ask anyone who's been associated with him what he was so good at, they do find it quite hard to put their finger on it. He was just a brilliant motivator, a brilliant studier of people. He could read your reactions, give you exactly what you needed. Is that fair?
That's absolutely fair. And I've often said to people that he was highly intelligent.
Mm.
He didn't think he was, but he was. He was highly intelligent. He was a fabulous football manager, but I think you could have put him in any walk of life, and as a manager, he would have succeeded.
Mm.
He just had that, you know, that aura about him.
Mm.
I mean, it's like this building here.
Mm.
If he walked in the building and there was a crowd of people, immediately everyone would just turn their head.
It's that charisma, basically. Yeah.
Unbelievable charisma.
Yeah.
Now, you transfer that, you know, to his team of 11 players who played for him on a Saturday. You know, we did everything he asked of us.
Mm.
And we'll be tied if we didn't do it.
Mm.
You know, if we were, for example, as a forward, you know, if I was to allow the fullback to make a run down, you know, into an advanced position, and he could see that I could have gone to maybe close him down or maybe just put a little tackle in to slide the ball out for a throw-in. We never thought twice about doing it.
Mm.
The reason we didn't think twice about doing it was because, you know, you only want to get on the end of a tongue lashing from him on once or twice, and you don't want that to happen again.
Right.
And I've seen that. I've felt it.
Yeah.
And it's very intimidating.
Mm.
You know, so you don't want that too often.
No. And when you said earlier about how all the stuff he did was planned, and the couple of the references I mentioned, which I felt like I felt like quite a lot of empathy for you in that situation, because you're a young man under a lot of pressure. And you said, oh yeah, but it's all planned, and he knew what he was doing. Did he say that to you behind the scenes? Don't worry about what I do in the press or in the media. Just worry about what we do here.
Never.
No, okay.
No. I spoke some, you know, 5 minutes ago about the fact that, you know, there were occasions when I wasn't able to play because I was cup tied, but he'd always take me with the group, and he was big on, you know, spirit in the dressing room, having a togetherness, and everyone used to try, you know, he wanted everyone to help one another. So I think he quite enjoyed, you know, on one occasion when I wasn't able to play, and he turned to me and said, Trev, listen, you know, you're not involved today. These lads, you know, are going to work, you know, try and win the match, you know, for yourself.
Mm.
Get him a cup of tea. Get me a tea.
Oh, really?
Get Peter a cup of tea.
Really? Okay.
So, but then he would go and tell the press. So I then, the following day or the day after, I became known as the million-pound tea boy. And he quite enjoyed that, because what it did was, I think he felt it was good for the other players, because there were a number of players in that team who were actually free transfers.
Yeah, of course.
And didn't get any kind of recognition, no acclaim at all.
Mm.
He didn't want everything to revolve around the big million-pound footballer.
Mm.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
I was particularly excited to have an opportunity to ask you about what it was like moving to Sampdoria in the early 80s. I know you played for Man City in between, but yeah, you spent a number of years in Italy at a time when it would be far harder for a person to go over to a different country and play in a different league. The world felt like it was a lot bigger then, I think. The connections between people were a lot less obvious. How did you find moving to Sampdoria and a completely different way of life and a different way of playing the game? And why did you decide to go?
Okay, yeah. I just finished the World Cup in Spain with England in 82 as a Man City player. And I was, looking forward to going back to have my second year at Main Road. That's not a mistake, by the way. It was Main Road in those
days. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I didn't realise that Sampdoria were looking for a front player. They had just been promoted to the top division in Italy. So they were watching me, playing for England. And when the tournament finished, they approached me. It took me by surprise. I made the decision primarily because financially it was just a fantastic offer.
Right.
I mean, the English Premier League now is awash with money, as we know. Mm. In them days, Italy was the place, compared to, to England. So I went primarily because of the money, but it was such a good choice, such a good decision. I loved every minute of my time in Italy, more so at Sampdoria. I had 4 years at Sampdoria when we always played, to try and win. We always played for the top of regions of the league. My last year, I was transferred to Atalanta, who coincidentally are doing very well at the moment. They just qualified, for the knockout stages of the Champions League, which is pleasing. But now, in every club, you were allowed two foreign players. I joined up with Liam Brady, who had just signed for Sampdoria from Juventus. And, with Italy having just won the World Cup, everything was like, fever pitch in Italy. I mean, they're passionate anyway about the football, but at that time, there was such a great influx as well of foreign players. The likes of, where do we start? Zico, Platini, Boniac, there was Rummenigge, there was Maradona. Not in 82, may I add, Maradona. He came
a bit later,
Yeah, but, throughout my time, I was able to play against these guys. And it was just a wonderful experience.
And did you find it a culture shock to move to a different country and have a different way of life? Or did you find that you adjusted to that quite well?
I think I adjusted well. It was a different type of football.
Is it harder to get space, harder to score goals?
All those things.
Yeah.
Harder to find space. There was more of a defensive approach. The chances that, you had... sometimes you go two or three, games without getting a good chance.
Really? That much?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, it was I mean, tactically as well, I learned so much. Mm. I mean, what surprised me was, you know, the quality of the coaching. Mm. But not just from the coach, you know, my teammates, they'd obviously grown up, you know, with an education on the tactical side of football. Mm. You know, I remember as a youngster, I wasn't really coached. The first time I was really coached was in 1981 by John Bond at Manchester City. Mm. So I was learning all the time. And of course, you know, playing in that kind of football against, you know, defences that were very, very good. I mean, everybody wanted to be a striker, didn't they, in England?
Sure, of course, yeah.
And still
yeah.
they do. But in Italy, they wanted to be defenders.
Right.
So there's some very, very good defenders. And I think it helped me at national level. Because I was an England player mm. and I had a few more years, you know, in the England team. And I think I benefited from playing in Italian football.
And do you think it helps you as a coach as well?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that, you know, you never stop learning.
Yeah.
And as I was going along in Italy, I mean, in the early days, to be honest, I never considered, you know, management. The first time I considered going into management was, you know, when I saw Graham Souness managing at Glasgow Rangers. Because I played for Graham for 1 year and I started to become quite interested then in the managerial side. And then it was thrust upon me, you know, at QPR.
Mm. We'll come on to your management career. Oh, you mentioned England there a couple of times. I do want to talk about that as well. Another quote I dug up from you is that you obviously played 52 times for England, but you had some problems with your Achilles tendon, didn't you? So you missed a lot of football through injury.
Yeah.
You said if you had been playing today and you'd been a bit luckier, you would have got 100 caps, you think. And obviously no reason to doubt that at all. But is your England career maybe tinged with a little bit of regret? Or do you feel you could have achieved more? Or was that just that you were a victim of the circumstances?
I think I could have achieved more throughout my career.
Right.
But that's me, you know.
Because you always want to do more.
Yeah, but I also think back to the first question that was asked about, you know, me leaving Plymouth to come up to Birmingham. Mm. And that was an honest answer. Mm. You know, my ambition was to play regularly in the youth team. Mm. You know, I'd had a knockback, you know, when I had a trial for the English schools team. And I didn't get past the first trial.
Right.
So that put serious doubts in my mind. So I came up to Birmingham thinking, you know, if I can establish myself in the youth team. So, you know, when I think back at my career now, do I have regrets? I suppose there's always regrets, but I'm so pleased, you know, what I've achieved and what I've done. You know, many, many people would be absolutely thrilled to play 52 times for their country, but I was handicapped throughout my career at club level and international level by injuries. Mm. So it did prevent me from playing many, many times for my country. But listen, I had 9 years playing for my country. Mm. You know, not many had 9 years playing for England.
No. And what kind of environment was it at England at that time? Just give people a flavour of what it was like in that era.
Well, we didn't used to qualify that often for major competitions. So
we're at a fever pitch about England these days, aren't we? We're very excited. But what was it like back then?
Well, you know, I look back on, you know, actual attempting to qualify and, you know, some of the games that we played were particularly tough. I mean, I'm not undermining the current player, don't get me wrong, but there's so many easy games now. You know, when I look at some of the England matches, you know, it's particularly, you know, it's particularly easy, I think, you know, to qualify for major tournaments. But
particularly the Euros, which have just expanded and made it even easier, yeah.
And in my time, you know, I talked about 9 years, yeah? Now, we qualified for the European Championships in my time, and I was injured, 1980, couldn't play in it. Mm. 82 in the World Cup. That's the only qualification we had. I also look at, you know, as a forward player, you know, my goals record, you know, 52 games, 12 goals. I'm not proud of that.
Right.
I've actually scored 12 goals, you know, for my country, which it's okay, you know, could have been a lot better. I think I'd have scored a lot more if I was playing today because the quality of teams they're playing against.
Yeah.
I'm not taking anything away from the Harry Kane. And
I understand. You'd be honest. I understand.
Raheem Sterling.
Yeah.
You know, some of the games that they're playing in now, you know, it's a damn sight easier scoring a goal than it was in my time. But, you know, that's not me, you know, sour grapes. That's just, you know, that's just fact.
Was the sort of adjustment between club football and international football playing under a different manager? Did the manager at international level want you to play a slightly different role or do something different that didn't? Or was it not like that?
That happened. It was only the latter part of my England career when I became what I consider to be a regular, you know, under Bobby Robson. I don't think I'd have played in that 82 World Cup, you know, from a starting position if Kevin Keegan had been fit.
Right, okay.
Kevin was the regular starter. So once again, you know, I look back and think, how fortunate was I? Mm. I played in all five matches in the World Cup. Kevin was injured for most of them. If I had not started in all them five games, would Sampdoria have bothered to watch me?
Yeah.
So would I have played in Italy? Mm. You know, listen, you have your ups and you have your downs, but I certainly enjoyed every match I played for my country. It was a special moment, regardless of whether it was a friendly or a World Cup qualifier. To me, they were all the same. Mm. You know, once you had that national anthem, it became a very, very important occasion.
Yeah.
And I loved every minute of my time in those 9 years. None more so than my debut. 1977 at Wembley against Holland, playing against the great Naiskins and the even greater Johan Cruyff.
Yeah.
Magical moments.
They the part that, do you think Cruyff and Naiskins would be the finest players you played on, shared a pitch with?
Certainly Cruyff. You know, I played with one or two greats over in Italy.
Yeah.
Maradona.
Yeah.
I didn't think I'd ever see a player as good as Maradona or play against anybody as good as Maradona. Listen, I'm still an avid watcher of football. Absolutely love the sport. I think you can tell that the way
I can. Yeah, absolutely. Very passionate.
I think I'm fortunate. I talked about that I played for 9 years for my country. I'm also very fortunate that I'm able to watch the brilliance of Messi and Ronaldo.
Yeah.
Because what they've achieved over the last, the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Has been quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
These are two players that will go down in history as, if not the two greatest, certainly in the top three or four. Now, that's a bit of a contradiction because I didn't think I'd ever see anybody better than Maradona.
Yeah.
But these two are exceptional.
Well, and you talked about Brian Clough's aura, for example. When you shared a pitch with Diego Maradona, did he have the same aura about him when he was playing?
I played against him down in Naples for Sampdoria.
Well, that must have been some experience playing in Napoli at that time.
Marvellous experience. And then I played for Atalanta up in Bergamo.
Were you pleased that you weren't defending against him?
Yeah, he was special. And do you know what was even more special? After the game, we swapped shirts.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you still have the shirt?
I do.
Amazing.
And
great.
Wonderful moment.
That's amazing. That is absolutely fantastic to hear. I could talk about you and Maradona all day, but I want to move on to your coaching career now because you've made a big contribution in the area of management as well. And I know your good friend Jim Smith, who sadly passed away recently, is on your mind at the moment. And you took over from him as player manager at QPR. I'll come on to a bit about that and how tough that might have been in a moment. But Jim Smith is someone who weaved his way throughout your career, really. Because did he sell you at Birmingham City to Nottingham Forest? And you worked with him very closely. And I know he was a good friend and what a great football guy as well.
Yeah, he came in 1978 at Birmingham City. And I think it was the first day he had a meeting with myself and said, listen, you know, I know that you've been keen to get away. I fully understand that. He said, you're ambitious. I'm ambitious. He said, give me 3 or 4 months, he said, and we'll reassess it after Christmas.
Mm.
He said, I want you to give me everything, and if we're no better placed in the league, I'll do everything I can to get you away.
Mm.
And that was so refreshing for me because I had been trying for a number of years. And I said to Jim, I said, listen, don't worry about me not giving everything.
Mm.
You know, I will give absolutely everything to you and this football club. Anyway, things had not improved and he was true to his word.
Right.
And from that moment on, when he sold me for £1 million, we became exceptionally close as friends and family friends.
Mm.
You know, in recent years, Jim lived over in Marbella, where I've spent a lot of my time over the last 15 years. You know, sadly, my wife died 2.5 years ago, but, you know, Jim and Yvonne, Helen and myself, you know, we've spent hours and hours together. You know, we've dined together. We've been on the beach together. We've done many, many things together. We travel together. Throughout football, you meet a lot of people, a lot of nice people. Jim has got to be up there as one of my closest friends. And it's been a sad last 48 hours. You know? Very, very sad. He's one of them guys that, you know, seldom do you meet in football when I don't care who I would be speaking to. Everyone would have a good word to say about Jim Smith. He was held in the highest respect. Fun guy to be with. He really knew his football. Just a lovely, lovely man.
Yeah, you said to me before we came in, you said, you'll not find anyone who's got a bad word to say about Jim.
And if somebody did, I would question that guy.
Yeah, quite. I mean, obviously a completely different way. He's given me some of my best football memories as well, because he managed a club I support. So very, very sad time. When you played under him again at QPR, and he sadly obviously lost his job there, you went from being a player there, senior pro there, to taking on the role of player manager. And that must have been an incredibly difficult thing for a couple of reasons. One, because Jim's your friend, but also because you've gone from being one of the guys to the main guy.
Yeah.
How did you make that adjustment?
Well, when I came down to QPR, I was 35 years of age and I wanted to continue playing. I felt fit. Mm. I wasn't getting enough, game time with Graham up in Glasgow Rangers, Graham Souness.
Yeah.
So I came down to play for QPR and I started scoring goals, and some exceptional goals when I was at QPR. Mm. And you know, the London press, they were actually talking about me making a return to the England team.
Brilliant.
I knew that wasn't possible. At 35 years of age, they weren't going to return to me. But
was that 3 or 4 years after you'd last played for them?
Yeah. It would be. But listen, I knew I was playing well. Mm. Jim left to go to Newcastle. Mm. What a great opportunity for Jim at Newcastle.
I say he lost his job. Sorry, I should have made it clear that he moved on to Newcastle United. Yeah.
He moved up to Newcastle. Mm. And I was surprisingly given the job as, you know, player manager. And it was my first, you know, job in football.
Did you want it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was an opportunity for me to get into it. Mm. I think I was ready then. It took me by surprise. I mean, and the chairman took me by surprise too, because he was only 25 years of age. And he was, the first meeting we had, he said, we're in a little bit of a precarious position. He said, but I've got confidence in you that, you know, you'll get us clear relegation. He said, I'm a Tottenham fan. He said, and I've looked at the fixtures and the penultimate home game, he said, is against Tottenham. Mm. I went, oh yeah, chairman. And he said, what I want you to do, if we're clear of relegation, make me sub and bring me on for the last 20 minutes.
What?
Yeah.
Did he really?
So you're laughing now. And that's what I did. I started laughing when I suddenly realised he was serious. Of course, it didn't happen. But
was he a player at all?
No, he just, he managed the football club and he just thought, love to get on that pitch and kick the ball about.
Does that tell you everything you need to know about some of those chairmen?
Yeah, it told me a little bit about football.
I know what Brian Clough would say about that.
Exactly. Yeah. But it was quite an introduction to football management.
I bet. And you didn't stay at QPR for too long, and your next job in management was at Sheffield Wednesday, which of course, I think is probably when I first became aware of you as a manager. How did you look at your time at Sheffield Wednesday? And this was a really interesting time for football, wasn't it? Because the Premier League came into play. The game as we see it now, there's a lot made, isn't there, about how football didn't start in 1992, and we know that. But what we see now in football, this commercial beast that the game is in this country, really started in that period, and you were right amongst it.
Well, I was asked to join Sheffield Wednesday by Ron Atkinson, and I thoroughly enjoyed playing for Ron. Mm. Ron's been an outstanding manager, and I haven't met too many players who have played under Ron who's had a bad word to say about him. Mm. You know, they enjoy playing for him. Mm. I certainly did that. He then had the opportunity, Ron, to move to Aston Villa, which was, a great move for him. And he recommended to the Sheffield Wednesday board that I should be the next manager. Now, I took the opportunity, but I had to change my style, because when I went in at QPR, I tried to sort of implement the training methods that were being used over in Italy that Graham Souness was using up in Glasgow with Glasgow Rangers. It worked for Graham. Players were, happy to, do that kind of work. But down at QPR, they kind of resented, the way that I was, the discipline, and I was dismissed.
Is that because you've been a player as well? They just weren't having it. Or just because I didn't want to do it?
Just didn't want to do it. Mm. You know, I think there are all different types of dressing rooms. Mm. And obviously there were, you know, there were players in that dressing room who didn't really want to do the type of training that was day-to-day sort of training in Italy. Mm. They had their own little regime, little standards that they had, and it wasn't what I wanted. Mm. So anyway, you know, in that situation, there's only one loser, and that's me. So yeah. I was dismissed. So second time round, I had to change. I'd looked to see what Ron had done at Sheffield Wednesday. I worked for him, of course, as a player. So I just tried to let it continue. I didn't try and alter too much because I knew that the players were happy with the way that they worked under Ron.
Mm. And you played for quite a few games for Sheffield Wednesday as well.
Yes, I did. I played a number of games. You know, we won the League Cup final. We beat Manchester United. I came into the club as the manager in the top division. And in my first season, we actually got to third in the league.
That's right.
And it was only on the penultimate Saturday that we were ruled out of the title race, which was won by Leeds United and Howard Wilkinson beating Manchester United to the title. But you know, we're then in Europe. You know, we played in what was then the Cup Winners' Cup. We got through to two cup finals.
Yeah.
On both occasions, we were against Arsenal, and we lost both.
Yeah. you don't seem too bitter about that.
If I had a choice, I'd have preferred to have played one of them against Tottenham.
Right, okay.
Arsenal played Tottenham in the FA Cup semi-final, and Sheffield Wednesday played Sheffield United in the other, both at Wembley. Hmm. Actually, the Sheffield United game was the biggest game of all the occasions we played at Wembley. We played at Wembley four times in the space of a month because obviously the semi-finals were played there.
Yeah.
There was a replay in the FA Cup final. Mm. But it was difficult against Arsenal. Mm. You know, George Graham was, a shrewd tactician. Mm. He smothered us. We were a very expansive team. You know, our best player was Chris Waddle. Mm. One of my best signings was Chris. I signed him from Marseille. Mm. How things have changed. I flew over to Paris by myself to have a meeting in an office where I was given the address, and it was one-to-one. And the guy I was talking with was the president of Marseille Football Club, Bernard Tapie.
Yeah.
Who was, you know, very famous at the time.
Yeah.
I conducted the negotiations. I got Chris in for £1 million, and it's the best £1 million that Sheffield Wednesday have ever spent. I wouldn't think there's been a better player in the history of Sheffield Wednesday than Chris Waddle. Mm. That year, he should have regained his place in the international team. He didn't, but he was named Footballer of the Year, and rightly so. He was brilliant.
Mm. And around that time, I believe I'm right in saying, this might be an urban myth, so forgive me if it is, that you tried to sign Eric Cantona for Sheffield Wednesday. Is that true?
Well, that's the way it was reported, but there was never any suggestion of me signing Eric Cantona. Mm. But that wasn't made clear.
Right.
I'll keep it as brief as possible. Eric Cantona was out of football. He'd retired. Michel Platini was the international manager, French manager, and he wanted to try and get him back in the shop window. Mm. So he approached my agent, Dennis Roach, and Dennis said, listen, you know, can you give Eric 2 or 3 days training, let it, you know, people write about him? I said, fine. I said, as long as there's an understanding here that, you know, there's no way that we've just come into this league that we could actually, you know, afford Eric Cantona. Mm. You know, so I'm doing it. And the club also, you know, cannot foot the bill. Mm. You know, flights, hotels, it's got to be done by whoever, but not Sheffield Wednesday. Mm. So he was there for 3 days. Adverse weather conditions. We couldn't train on our training ground. We had to go over to Rotherham on AstroTurf. Then he was at the Sheffield Arena indoors playing on, you know, in the indoor stadium there. And the press started to write, oh, Cantona, like, what a player. Wednesday going to sign him. Well, I said, listen, this is just ridiculous. At that moment, Howard Wilkinson came in. I said, with pleasure, you know, you take him. Mm. Give him a few days training, you know. He didn't want to stay any longer with me. He felt that he was being asked to go on trial. That was that was never the case.
That wasn't the case.
No, I wouldn't insult somebody like Cantona. But he came with a huge entourage, you know, press agents, you know, physios. He was obviously a big player. So he moved to Leeds. And to this day, you know, I've often been asked, you know, how could you not see that, you know, Cantona, you know, he was such a good player. I said, listen, it wasn't a case. I was never, ever in a position where I could sign or even contemplate signing him.
Well, you set the record straight there then.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the book and I try to make it as clear as possible. Mm. When I look back, in hindsight, I should have made it clearer 20 years ago when I was at Sheffield Wednesday.
Yeah, absolutely. When you left Sheffield Wednesday, you left them, I think, 13th in the top flight, and they were in, you know, pretty good shape, I think, relatively speaking, particularly in what's gone on since. How did you feel about being relieved of your position there? Did you think it was unfair?
Well, I was there for 4 years as manager. First season, we were third. Then we had a seventh. Then we had a seventh. In the fourth season, I decided that one or two players I felt, you know, were coming towards the latter part of their careers. They could still play, but I needed to freshen it up, get a little bit more, you know, youth into the team, a little bit more athleticism. So I changed it around a little bit. But unfortunately, you know, the board, they didn't back me on this. So, of course, results started to suffer. We, as you rightly said, finished 13th in the league, and I was sacked. Still to this day, you know, I meet Sheffield Wednesday fans and they look back and think, you know, what could have been. Those were great days. They can't ever swap those days. I love my time. It's a big club, Sheffield Wednesday. Very, very passionate they are in the city of Sheffield, you know, about their football. And as I say, Wednesday are a big, big club. And it's sad to see that so many of my clubs are actually in the Championship. You know, we've talked about QPR, we've talked about Birmingham, we've talked about Nottingham Forest, we've talked about Sheffield Wednesday. I want them all back in the Premier League.
Trevor, I'll tell you what's a real testament to you and your time at Sheffield Wednesday as the manager there, is that I regularly, semi-regularly in this line of work, meet football fans all the time. And there's quite a lot of, there's a, quite a smattering of them who are around my age who, despite having no connection to Sheffield, support Sheffield Wednesday, because when they were coming up at like 10, 11 years old, they loved watching Chris Waddle. They loved watching that Sheffield Wednesday team, and they support them now for the rest of their lives. That's an amazing legacy to leave.
Thank you very much. And just quickly there, I mean, I spoke about Chris Waddle. We also had Andy Sinton. We had Carlton Palmer. We had Chris Woods. We had Des Walker. Now, what are they, all they, what do they all have in connection?
Great, yeah.
They're all England players. Yeah, you know, so Roland Nielsen, Swedish international. We had top players. No, it was great to be in Sheffield Wednesday. I didn't do bad as a player there either for Ron Atkinson. I was there for about 18 months, but that kind of gets overlooked. I don't mind that, because if they want to talk about what I did as a manager, I'm more than happy. But I also contributed as a player.
Yeah, you, when you played...
Until I was 39.
You played about 100, maybe almost 100 games for them at that age. Something like that.
Do you know, I would love to have played till I was 40.
Yeah.
But do you know the manager wouldn't select me? Do you know that manager was?
Go on.
Me.
You.
Me.
It's your own fault then.
As I was improving the team, I was making it harder to justify
by
my
playing.
Selection.
Did you find that difficult?
Well, yeah, the team was getting stronger and stronger. And obviously, all I was interested in is getting results. I wasn't interested in whether Trevor Francis could play.
But were you tempted? I'll give myself 10 minutes.
At all.
No. Well, that's a testament to the character you are, Trevor.
But it would have been nice, you know, if I wasn't involved in management, then I'd have played till I was 40 because I kept myself in good nick.
Yeah, fair enough. Obviously, you went on to manage other clubs as well, and I'm conscious that we're taking up a lot of your time. So the one question I really desperately want to ask you, though, is that you've been out of the game for a very long time now, and I understand, you know, you may have your own reasons for that. Maybe you won't even want to talk about them, but I think it's been 16 years since you were last in the game. I know you've been in the media and stuff. When you stopped managing, you were a relatively young man. Why did you not take another job? What was the reason?
Well, my last managerial position was Crystal Palace.
Yeah.
And I finished at the age of 49. It was my 49th birthday. Of course, I recall it. That night, I went to see Paul McCartney. That's my other great passion, his music.
Yeah.
And I kind of had a feeling that as I was leaving Palace, that was the end. You never say never. But
why do you think you felt that?
I just had enough of it.
Right.
I'd had enough of management. I enjoyed the media. I've been for a long time associated with, you know, Sky Sports and BT, BT Sport, and I've enjoyed my time as a commentator or as a pundit. Not doing so much now. The loss of my wife 2.5 years ago has really taken its toll. It's had a huge effect on myself. There's still a passion, you know, for football, but I don't do so much now. But there'll always be an interest from me in professional football. As much as it's changed today, I still, you know, can't take my eye off it.
Trevor, it's been an absolute pleasure. This has been an amazing story told of a life in football. We thank you very much for joining us. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for making it so interesting, because, you know, without the quality of questions...
Wow, Trevor, now you're flattering me.
No, I'm listen, I'm an honest guy.
This was a Stakhanov production.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.